the chance to run out and meet you. This is accounting for small presses. I want to say before we even begin that this is one of those sessions where truly, there's no such thing as a stupid question. This is a topic that virtually none of us, except to take virtually none of us is trained in. We find ourselves having to do the best we can. And sometimes we end up utilizing systems and producing documents for years without knowing really what they're for and how to actually read them. So that's what this is for. We're going to go over some incredibly basic things that I'm going to guess that for each of them, at least one of you, if not everyone, never really knew exactly what it was. And then we will actually address some fairly complex things as well and try to answer whatever questions we can in this very, very short time. So let me say that I'm Jeffrey Lappendorf, the Executive Director of Small Press Distribution. I'm here with Frank Cunningham, Managing Director of Small Press Distribution, and our special guest, Rafay Khalid of the Global Lit Fund, who we're particularly delighted to have here because he's an actual finance person. We've been faking it for years and learned a lot of things along the way, and Rafay has actual training.
Fair enough.
All right, here. So I just want to start with just to see who's here. Who here is representing a small publisher? Is anyone here not representing a small publisher? I'm just curious. Wow, why on earth are you here? You think you're kind of telling me, Mike?
Oh, yeah, learn more about how the book business works, publishing business.
Oh, learn how publishing works? No, I'm thrilled. I'm totally here. To a lot of us, actually, this stuff is really fun and kind of fascinating, but I know it can also be scary, confusing, off-putting. And they seem boring, but trust me, it's not. in terms of those who are publishing now and already have to keep some books, who is currently doing everything by hand? What I mean by hand is not necessarily pencil and paper, but not using accounting software, just using like Excel or doing their best. Yeah. Okay, now you're definitely in the right place. Because you need to go beyond that. You absolutely have to, like the day you're home from here. Going beyond that, who already does have some kind of inventory or customer system? I'm just curious, who uses perhaps Access or FileMaker for their publishing stuff? Okay. Is anyone here paying royalties? Wow, okay, great. And who here is already using QuickBooks? Great. Who here would say that they're somewhat comfortable with Excel? Okay, good. All right, great. All right, so we're going to begin by going over some basic accounting vocabulary, show you a few examples. Our first one is up. Because these are some of those things that, as I said, probably many of you have been producing for years, and maybe you've never really known exactly what it's for or how to read it. And so now is the time to ask all the questions. So the first piece that we all want to know about is the balance sheet. If you are using, QuickBooks, or equivalent, a basic accounting piece of software, one thing it's as impressive about is producing balance sheets. So the question is, what is it? So, gentlemen, what do you want to just address, basically, what a balance sheet is? What is it for? What does it basically tell us?
A balance sheet will tell you famously your assets and your liabilities. Those are the two sides of the balance sheet. So things that traditionally a balance sheet will give you a snapshot of a picture in time. If you the accounting works around the notion of that you had to close tomorrow, sell everything in there. How much would you get for all your computers and everything you got? How much would you get for your inventory? Those are all assets. And then how much could you collect from it? Everybody owes you, that's an asset. It's called accounts receivable. And then you have liabilities, accounts payable, people you owe, anything that you have outstanding debt on that side. And then there's the assets minus the liabilities in for-profit accounting is called equity, but in non-profit accounting it's called net assets.
Right.
So they're all confused to everybody. They've changed the names between these two kinds of accounts.
Yeah. And Rafay, maybe you could tell us, why is it called a balance sheet? What's balancing here?
So the balance sheet is basically a point in time. So this could be as of December 31st. Generally, for most presses and publishers, it's the fiscal year, so January 1st to December 31st. The point in time is December 31st. So if you're, if a bank wants to give you a loan, you're looking to show your, get a grant, you have to click the button, put the balance sheet, and it's a point in time, whereas the income statement is current, historical. This is this point, this date, it can be different January 1st. And that's important as you're filling out those grant applications. They'll ask you for things like these, or even your award. Some presses meet annually, so they're preparing, and they need to have this as part of their package for financials.
Right. It could also measure your fiscal year if you were a June 30th organization. But why is it called balance? What's balancing?
Oh, the assets. The assets on one side, the liability, and
can you scroll up to basically the bottom, I think. Wait, so we can see the very bottom. Oh, is that the very bottom?
Yeah.
So can we see what's the balance? There we go. Yeah. So you see the assets number? Right, and then you see total liabilities at the bottom there. And you see something in common with those two numbers, right?
They're both supposed to match up. If they're not, then something's off and it has to balance. It has to be equal. Otherwise, you did something wrong.
Right. So basically, if those two numbers are different, there's an error somewhere. So it has to balance. So you might think at first, like, well, if the number's the same, why do I bother with this, making this form? The answer is, if they don't match, something's wrong. So it's a quick way to know that you've been accounting for things. Simple as that, right? And it tells you basically, as Frank's saying, you know, what you owe and what you have of value. And the difference, right? So if you have negative net assets forever, that might be something to think about.
You'll go out of business.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so next we have, the next basic thing is the what's often generally called a P&L statement or a profit and loss statement. I think we have an example.
Yeah, there's one.
And here's another example of something that, again, if you're using QuickBooks, which probably most of you kind of want to be using, press of a button, it will spit out a P&L statement. And the P&L statement is different than the balance sheet. And maybe one of you can tell us a little bit about what's unique about the profit and loss statement. We kind of, it was mentioned a little bit, but we're not sure.
We have this on our sheet, but I do think it's worth saying that in accounting, there's non-profit accounting, for-profit accounting, there's a lot of different synonyms. And this is the big one where there's a lot of words that describe what's functionally the same thing. So if you hear the word income statement, which I don't know if they just used, earnings report for profit, profit and loss, P&L, operating statement, or especially non-profit accounting, the statement of financial activity, those are all equivalent, and they're all essentially, I think of it as like you make a budget before the year starts, you have income and expenses, and then at the end of the year, what you have is a P&L. You have the actuals as the budget is filled in. What did you actually have that was income? What did you actually have that was expense, right?
Yeah. You can also spit out a P&L for the fiscal year through today or the calendar year through today. So it can be just up to date. It doesn't have to be at any specific period. I know myself, you know, running off the public, I will look at a P&L statement all the time just to see where we are. Did that money come in from that grant?
It's important, so you want to see the historical stuff. If you're waiting on a grant to come in, and you owe the printer $10,000, you're going to be short. So you need to know where your cash is at all times, because your expenses will come in, and the grant sometimes will come in a little later. I think Jeff mentioned sometimes they come later, and you have a bill, so now you have to call the printer and say, can you be okay if it's a little bit late?
Right, so notice that this P&L statement is showing you actual money, real money, cash money. It's not theoretical. It's not showing necessarily like an asset grant that is owed to you, which is an asset, but you may not have the money in hand. The P&L says, oh, there it is. You're going to see what's actually there. So it's a real picture of real money. So it's good to look at all the time to know how much money you have, which sounds easy, but it's actually not so easy. An important difference between a P&L statement for a for-profit business, I'm assuming most or all of your not-for-profit entities are operating as such, is if you look across the top. So this example is comparing years, which is great. So this is one way to look at a P&L where you can have it compare years, which is good to do to see how much you have for a particular category in other years and see if things are really different. But if we, I think this one doesn't just show this year.
Just the one column, the general column.
Yeah, but this isn't breaking things down
into cost centers.
It's better than cost centers. Isn't it numbered?
No, no, admin fundraising.
Oh, okay. It's not a number.
This is not a non-profit. Okay, so this is a for-profit panel. It should have been one, sorry. As well, if you're a non-profit. Here's the one thing that's different. So in a not-for-profit one, it does all the things this does, but you have one more thing you have to do. Okay? So the categories on the left are called accounts. I think in both for-profit and not-for-profit. And those are categories like printing, paying consultants. They're fairly standard things. In a not-for-profit, you have to do one more division of things, and across the top, in other words, not the rows, but the columns, you have what some people call cost centers, and some people call classes. In QuickBooks, they're called classes. And the reason you have to know about classes is that any dollar that comes in one of these categories, you also have to place or divide into three main things, and you have to do this legally, and you should know, even if you're teeny tiny, was the money used for toward program, which could be publishing, you know, toward your mission? Was it used for something that's purely admin, like paying a bank fee, that would be admin? Or is it used for fundraising? And once we'll talk about this later, but you get to the level of having to report to the federal government, you have to let them know how much of every dollar that was contributed to you because of your charity, how much went to program, how much went to administration, and how much went to fundraising. Ideally, 70% of every dollar is going toward mission-based work. Okay? If you're raising money and 90% of every dollar is going toward admin or fundraising, your not-for-profit status should be revoked, and may well be. Everyone clear on the classes and accounts? Great. Okay. So the next one, yeah, we're going to go to basic vocabulary, and then we'll, I think we'll take some questions, and we'll go into the answer stuff. So there are two different ways to account for things. Cash basis, or cash, and accrual basis. Accrual. So one of you want to tell us what it means to account by cash?
Sure. So I'll do cash. It's obvious cash in, cash out, which you actually spent, versus accrual, which is a different system. But cash is very basic. I always recommend that for people because as a small press, you don't have much in the way of like a depreciating asset. In an accrual basis, you bought the computer. You're going to use it for 5 years. You spent $1,000. So 1,000 divided by 5, that's how much you expense every year. Now, if you spent cash, you spent $1,000 in year one. Done and easy. Less bookkeeping, less headache, you could focus on your mission. So I always recommend do cash. What you spent, what you did, that's it. No messing around.
And accrual, on the other hand.
But you then described accrual there. So you're looking at your assets as they degrade over time. So you can spread out some of those costs. You can make things look a little better, look a little worse, because if you have a strong year, you can tinker things a little bit.
But there is one other aspect of accrual accounting that often is really useful for non-for-profits at the point that you might be getting grants. Mm-hmm. And that is that you generally get a letter saying you've been promised, it's called a promise to give. You get a letter saying you've been awarded, you know, $2,000. Now, on a cash basis, you have to remember that. We're going to get $2,000 eventually. But you don't see it because it's not cash in hand. If you were using accrual accounting, that $2,000 would be there as owed to you. And it would show up differently. You would know you didn't have it in hand, but it would show up as an accrued asset. It would show up as money that's coming to you. So there are advantages to both. Starting off, certainly cash is going to be much, much easier. At a certain point, though, with the loss of grants, you might want to shift to accrual because it's harder to keep track of money that's been promised to you. Right, that you might be able to kind of spend or budget out because you know it's coming and it's fairly guaranteed. Does that make sense?
Okay. I think one thing you want to do and keep in mind is have a system that you do. So you know, write it down. Like I have some presses that have a folder, January through December, 12 tabs, and they just go through. What do I need to do in January, March, December, get ready for taxes, Whatever you do, have some sort of process, whether it's on scratch paper, put it in that notebook. That way you can always refer to it, because things can get lost in QuickBooks very easily.
Yeah, a little paper is so good, I say to your publishers. And the question there, I forgot, but I'm sure we'll come back. We want to mention one other basic kind of report that, again, if you're using QuickBooks for equivalent, spits out, and it's one that you've probably seen this on the list of the canned reports you can put in. Maybe you can skip this one or not know what it is, and it's quite important. One. It's called the trial balance. I think, do you have an example of the trial balance? Oh, you might not have it. We don't have one to show you, but Brett, do you want to just sort of explain what a trial balance is?
Yeah, your trial balance pulls all of your what's called your chart accounts. So these are all the accounts that feed into both the balance sheet, which we talked about, and the P&L, and takes the snapshot at that moment. And it just kind of lines them up, usually in what's called the general ledger. You've numbered these accounts. The balance sheet's accounts come first, so they'll be the lowest numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, and you can do that one. And then it goes into your P&L accounts. So it's useful to make sure that everything is balancing, because the P&L and the balance sheet have a relationship with each other. Something called double entry bookkeeping, which is what everything's doing. That's what the QuickBooks is doing behind the scene. So you're seeing debits and credits, and they have to all balance. You can get a glimpse of that. You can also, it's another way to kind of see where you are with your P&L if you want to see both P&L and balance sheet, how things are moving with your time.
Your trial balance looks, actually, it may sound like the most obtuse of all these things, but in some way, when I look the most familiar, it looks kind of like your checkbook. You know, if you keep a paper checkbook where you write down each check and you tally, that's what the trial balance. That is a trial balance. But you've all been doing it your whole lives if you've kept a checkbook. That's the trial balance. And it's good to look at it all the time because you tend to, because it's going check by check, mistakes pop out easier for you. They haven't necessarily been categorized. You just see right away, oh, wait, we did spend $2,000 on that, it was $200. You just notice it. Right. So you want to be looking, and you often switch between these three things that have a lot of similarities but are different, but also just that you catch different mistakes, and there will always be mistakes. Okay. The system may be perfect, but you are imperfect entering data. Okay. Let me ask you this point, and do not be shy. Are there any questions about any of these things? Balance sheet, P&L. Cash versus accrual, cash flow.
Yeah.
One of the most important. So the one other thing you can spit out is a cash flow report, which is a kind of a profit and loss statement in a way.
But you can't really spit it out, though, unless you go through it.
That's right. The difference is that
cash flow looks like the end of the future.
But you can spit out last
week. People often work a cash flow separate from their account. It can be very basic and it can be done in Excel. And what you're just trying to say is literally how much money do I think is going to come in terms of income, and map it as many months out into the future, right? So you're saying in July, I think that in actual cash in hand, I'm going to get this amount, I'm going to have this much expenses. What you're looking for is in that period, 3 months from now, am I going to be overdrawn in my bank, right? That's the core use of a cash flow. In that month, oh, yeah, that's right, the grant, I'm not going to get the physical money from that grant until August, but I have all these expenses in July. I literally won't have enough money at that point, so that's your cash flow.
Yeah. So you're
got to do something. I got to push that July stuff into August.
So if you're making it simple, even if you're using QuickBooks or even something more sophisticated, QuickBooks is probably fine for just about everything. You probably, in an Excel sheet or similar, a Google sheet, you know, some equivalent, you're going to want to make a cash flow and just have months across the top. And the left, the rows, are going to be the exact same account names. And this is where, for example, you've been awarded a grant and you're told to expect a check next January, and it's $2,000. Put $2,000 under foundation grants in that month. And then as you're doing your QuickBooks work, which is working probably on a cash basis, here's the money I actually have, here's the bills I actually just got, I'm gonna pay them or not. If you get a big bill and you're pretty shy and you see, oh, look at my cash flow, next month we're gonna get that $2,000, then maybe you can put off paying that one until next month. So that's how you plan using a cash flow. It's a very simple but very important thing. You always want to plan out the year as best you can. Once you have a little history from QuickBooks, you can print out an actual cash flow from last year, month by month. In any report to QuickBooks, by the way, there's always a little function on the top right that says custom, and you click that, and then you can choose from a pull-down menu what you want the columns to be. Because it'll just give you a default, which is probably the whole year or to date, and you can say one month by month. And if you were to spit out actually a P&L, profit and loss statement for last year by month, and then use that, unless you know which things will be different this year, but you have an idea like, oh, we tend to get a lot of fundraising checks in around end of December, January, if you do a year in fundraising letter. And the last 2 years we made between $1,000 and $2,000 each year. So I'm going to project the cash flow for this year, $1,200. I think I can safely assume that will be there. And so it's just a good way to look ahead,
well, let me make that an important distinction because these terms can be confusing. Cash-based accounting makes it sound like you're just dealing with the cash, right? So a sale, when you're in cash-based accounting, a sale still counts as a sale. You sold it, and now it's owed to you. It's in your cash-based accounting system, right? So that's an account receivable. But they haven't paid you yet. You don't have the cash in hand. So either cash accounting, you just got $10,000 because somebody bought $10,000 worth of books. But in your cash flow, you're like, I don't think that person can pay until probably 4 months out, right? So don't get confused between the cash is
and that's a
cash-based accounting is not based on just
it's not
money
just
in hand, not in hand.
But a sale is a sale. The idea is that the money's coming to you. The other word that was just introduced into a vocabulary word, important one, receivables. So you can still have a receivable. A sale was made, check is coming to you, you're going to receive it. So you still put the sale in the books. And then QuickBooks, well, when you actually get the money, you will put it against the receivable, and then it will show that you have it.
Yeah.
Anything more to say there?
Okay.
If you're stuck or have a problem, that's why at CLMP we have the accounting package and finance package. Depending on your level, you pay $300, $600, or $900. You sign up, I'll get an intro email, I'll introduce myself, schedule a time. We'll go through like a 1 hour, 30 to 60 minute phone call, address what help you need. It could be I've had royalties, forecasting for my board. I can't figure this out in Excel, I have a crude spreadsheet, and I'm stuck in QuickBooks. So then I'll like go through, have a list, laundry list of to-dos, and over the next couple of weeks, we'll go through and I'll probably say, for that, you might want to call QuickBooks, talk to customer service. But at CLMP, it's great because that resource is there, whereas before, it's very difficult to do. So you have access to that. And if there's budget constraints, you can apply for scholarships. We never want to turn people away because they don't have the money to pay. We want to support you in your mission, which you're, that's why it's really critical.
Any questions about any of these? Basic things, yeah. I'll repeat the questions to try to get a little succinct.
Sure. So, two questions. What was the name of your company that helps out with that?
It's Global Lit Fund, but I partner with CLMP. So, if
you can apply, if you're a CLMP member, on the website, look for member services, and then there you will find it says either accounting package or financial package. I forget what it's called. Accounting packages. You'll see accounting packages. And click on that and we'll give you all the information.
You said CLMP?
Yes, the Community of Literary Magazines and Presses. So for those who don't know, I should have said this at the beginning. Small press distribution is, many of you may be distributed by us. We're the only nonprofit literary book distributor, distributing about 400 small presses. We are one half of the world of small presses in America, the other half of the nonprofit world, the other half is CLMP. With the trans overlap in the Community of Literary Magazines and Presses, CLMP.org, the other one is SPDBooks.org. CLMP.org is your service organization. So you go to generally CLMP for technical assistance or advice, and you go to SPD for actual distribution. They work hand in hand a lot. Okay. So this is a remarkably wonderful thing offered through CLMP. You don't have to be a member of CLMP, but you can join us. It's inexpensive. Okay, any other questions? Yeah, we have one more. Yeah, we have a second question.
Yes, I'm a for-profit press,
sure.
And then we get an analysis that 5 months in advance what we will be paid out by the distributor. Should we go through an accrual system or cash system?
It's hard to say.
You're not getting grants. You probably, it's going to mostly affect things like whether you depreciate assets over time, right? That's going to be the difference. For a nonprofit that's getting grants, you want to maybe accrue those and show those grants beforehand. So a cash basis, much simpler,
there's still receivables.
Yeah, it's still.
The important thing for either of these systems, they each have their attributes, and at a smaller size, you don't have to worry too much, really. Cash is probably easier. The important thing I think everyone would agree is, when you pick one of them, you have to stick to it. You absolutely cannot mix the two together. That's when people get into trouble.
Yeah.
You're either cash or you're accrual. And you can read out more on either and decide which one is best for you. Cash is definitely easier. So that's the general recommendation. What's the question back there?
Oh, I just wanted to confirm what I think you already did, because I'm also a small for-profit press, that the distributor sent you that thing that says, we distributed X number of books for X number of dollars. And it sounds like you would mark that as receivables in our accounting software, and then 5 months later, when the cash is deposited in the bank account, we enter that into the receivables being paid.
That's exactly right. So you get a distributor report. It tells you the money you will be getting, the sales that happened. You put them in right away. The minute you know about a sale, you put it in the books. And it's put in as a receivable. And then when it's received, you go back into QuickBooks and you click that it was received.
Okay, that's what I mean. That's for cash or accrual.
Yes.
Account, either form, you're still booking this stuff when you know that it's coming, in a sense of a sale, you can have an account receivable. And in fact, you can also do this with grants. You can be in cash-based accounting system. You're told, you get the letter Jeffrey's talking about, and you book the grant as a receivable. It's a little bit weird, but it works, and it will remind you, Jeffrey's saying you forget, at least reminds you.
Yes, I said, you said a collection letter to your
It's a collection letter to your
Yeah. Well, often if you ever get a corporate gift, you often do have to keep invoicing them. That's quite common. So, yes, question.
So, as far as year-end accounting, that all complicates things? Potentially. So, if you have all this stuff that's owed and it hasn't come in, or returns, this is what messes up the end of your account that I have questions about.
Right.
Is like, so there's stuff that's still outstanding that you thought you were going to get, but doesn't go in that fiscal year.
Right.
Like, things start to get a little hairy, like you try to make those reports.
No, because, it's still a receivable. So it's still an asset, even if you haven't received it.
But would you count it into that fiscal year? No, because you haven't gotten paid for it yet.
If you're on a cash basis, yeah, go ahead.
So, the sale happens, right, in June, and your fiscal year ends at the end of June. Is that people know that they...
Or December.
December, that's the last day. So it goes into your P&L in that year, and you say, oh, great, we had a great year. I sold $1 million on the last day of December, right? But someone promised me, and we had a superb year. Meanwhile, that $1 million has actually moved up into accounts receivable. So it's considered in your, it's in your balance sheet, but you have to understand that the balance sheet travels through across time. It's constant. And you just pick a time, right? So it's going to move up there. What you end up having to do, if you're uncertain that you're really going to collect that $1 million over time, you have to start to think about making a bad debt.
Or
a cash balance entry against it, or you can build a contra account so that you don't peer at your balance sheet and think, wow, we are millionaires, when there's questions, which mainly go in and say, well, we're a little uncertain, it's murky.
Well, just to answer your specific question, though, as far as, say, like a tax return,
yes.
you earn that money. If that sale happened December 31st, even, you earn that money. It doesn't matter that you didn't get it yet. Now, you may not get all of it, and we'll get to what happens if you don't collect the money you're owed, but it's showing up as an asset, as a receivable for that year. When you close the books on the year, you're owed that money. It's an asset you have developed. Does that make sense? Even though you don't have it in hand.
Yeah.
Well, we'll
get,
well,
it makes sense. It's just hard when we're doing the tax return to make it all work.
Right.
I mean,
but
I understand what you're saying.
So there's a difference between the money you earned and the money you have in the bank.
Yeah.
That's simply put. So to keep it pure here, if you earn the money, even conceptually, you earn the money. And you know, the end of a calendar or fiscal year is a wall, even if it's artificial. And if something's on one side of the wall, it can't move to the other side of the wall. That's the way I think of it. It's when the year ends, if you, that sale happened, whether you got the money in hand or not, the sale happened. So you show that money, it is an asset. It might be receivable, you haven't gotten it in hand yet, but it's different than cash. Don't confuse it with cash.
Okay, so then, just to follow that up,
yeah.
So then the money comes in 6 months later.
Right.
And you're trying to match your bank statements with your, and then for the next tax year, you have this money that was actually from the year before.
Right, so I'm afraid that's a question. So you're saying, so that I get that, I get that the money shows up last year's tax return because it was books were sold then, but then I get the money this year, and I have these bank statements, so what do I do about that? So again, the difference between cash and tax return has to do with that artificial wall. So the fact that you got the money in the following year, like you were now, let's say, even though you earned it last year, does not matter. You don't show that money is earned again this year, you earned it last year. The fact that you got it this year is not part of the tax return. Tax return reflects the tax year. Case closed.
All right, but the, you know, the first line in your balance sheet is cash, and that's what's supposed to match with your bank account.
That's right.
So at the on December 31st, you just got $1 million, but your cash line has not moved in your balance sheet at all because you haven't had cash. So you're just looking at that cash line. Does that match my what I got in the bank? 6 months later, suddenly your accounts receivable, the amount you think you're owed, plummets by $1 million, and you just got $1 million in cash, and you just put the check in the bank, so the bank account now
so
will match.
Actually, now you're getting a good sense of what the balance sheet does for you as opposed to these other charts. So, so having sold $1 million can mean various things. One might mean you have $1 million in the bank, and one might mean you're owed $1 million. But they're both a sale of $1 million. Do you have a question, a follow-up question?
I'm just trying to think. If I earn $1 million on December 31st,
right,
and it goes on that year's tax return, but
that's
I don't
right.
get the money until June, that's a problem.
Yeah,
it is a challenge. It's a challenge. Because I'm going to skip a couple. You're not seeing my list of things here, but people talk about bad debt. Because
But I should point out, too, that, you know, with nonprofits who are not generally going to be taxed on that income
right.
have less concern about it.
Yeah.
But a for-profit, where
yeah.
it's going to look like income, you need to take that very, very seriously, especially if it was $1 million. Hopefully it's not.
Yeah.
But, you know, and there are many, and this is where you do need to start working with an account. There are many ways to, I wouldn't say exactly hide that
yeah.
income,
mm-hmm.
but you shift it and you into the to the other year.
But you want to say something about that?
Yeah, so
what happens when you don't get the money?
If you don't get the money, and why would you want to, like, not really hide it, but minimize it if you're a for-profit and paying taxes? You want to pay less taxes so you have more money to fulfill your mission. So you can figure out ways with your accountant. So maybe that depreciation over 5 years, you'll take it over 2 years to minimize that tax. It's different on the for-profit side.
Right.
Sorry, on the non-profit side.
Right. So again, for-profits, well, there are ways to depreciate, to spread out the debt over years, or even the income over years. That's depreciation. Not-for-profits don't generally do that, because it doesn't really matter. But when you're showing a funder, potential funder, you want to say, hey, we were promised all this money, but we only got 20% of it. And we planned based on the money we were promised, so we really need help. That's the difference. The other one is, we sold all these books, but then they were all returned 7 months later, and so we didn't really earn that money. Now we're showing a loss for the current year based on the sale of the previous year. Good question.
So, right now the way we're doing our accounting, we're not, when we ship books to distribution or Amazon, it's nowhere. And
right.
So we should count those as sales? No.
No.
The ones to Amazon,
yeah.
maybe, yes. Your sale to Amazon would be a sale.
Yeah.
You're shipping books to a distributor where they're holding them in the warehouse. You
yeah.
might treat that not as a, I wouldn't treat that as a
where's
sale
that,
generally.
Where does that go then? Because maybe we have $1,000 or $2,000 in inventory that down the road we might get paid for, but right now it's just darkness on our balance.
A distributor basically is holding them on consignment. They're still yours. So you might have as an asset
the inventory,
but it's not a sale until the distributor sells it and you get a check.
So when you're planning out cash flow, for instance.
Yes.
Oh yeah, put it in cash flow.
Cash flow, you want to, because you can make a prediction. But we're going to show you a little chart in a moment. We'll go question back up just a second. In a moment, I'll show you a little chart. It's a simple one. You can make more complex versions. I have a little way to plan out kind of cash flow based on a book you're creating.
Okay.
So we'll get to that in just a moment. But the answer is, again, when it goes to the distributor, until they sell it, it hasn't been sold. They're selling it on your behalf. It's just living somewhere else, that's all.
Right.
It could as well be in your garage.
So for accounting purposes, you make no assumptions on the size of the order that the distributor has placed.
Well, you can make some assumptions, but
you
can't know for sure.
That's
cash flow.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
You should be making some assumptions based on past sales of similar books.
Gotcha.
To plan cash flow. It's not your accounting. It's not part of your books. Question back there. Yeah.
Just to wrap this up in my mind, because I think I've been doing this wrong for years now.
Yeah.
So because of the 5-month advance notice of, like, you will have these sales coming from the distributor in 5 months, when December rolls around, I should be listing my final sales for December 31st as the projected sales for January, February, March, April, or May. And the bad thing about that is that they're projected, and that's not returns included. So I'm wondering, like, wouldn't I pay too much in taxes? So that number might go down because of returns.
Yeah, no, projected sales are projected. That's different than sales.
Oh, I'm sorry. So they're the sales you made, but they're delayed.
Your check will come later. No, then the sales happened, and they owe you money.
Well, I see. I mean, Jeremy's right in general, but I think we're getting to the territory where you've got to talk to a tax professional, because I do think at that point there's a lot of different ways to spin these numbers. Because you have a very different goal here, which is to minimize your tax burden. I don't think, I'm going to say not another three of us are at all qualified.
That is true. And there are various ways to deal with it as a for-profit, too, because you do want to kind of maybe hide some predicted income or move it somehow. But for a for-profit, I mean, for a not-for-profit, which is a little more, two-thirds of the bunch of years, and most of you really are not-for-profit publishers, for a not-for-profit, you know, the more sales, the better. And it's not that we're paying taxes, you don't pay those kind of taxes. So it's a very different world. But the answer is that there are various ways to deal with that, and you need to have an account look specifically at your situation for that answer. There's no one correct answer, there's multiple ones.
Let me go back to the inventory one. For that, if it's at a distributor, within QuickBooks, in inventory, you could put in a class and say, this is at Consortium, this is at SPD. So you could put in classes and where your inventory is. So you could kind of track it that way.
Yeah.
That's right.
Another word for classes is cost centers. That's often used in for-profit, too. And so you can make up different cost centers beyond fundraising, program admin. For not-for-profits within program, you can have all kinds of sub-columns, which might be sales of books, live event ticket sales, things like that. And even for for-profit, you can have different cost centers, and inventory might be one of them. So you kind of know where the money's going. That's different than printing, consultants, et cetera, shipping. Yeah.
I guess, as far as this industry is concerned, is there like a clear line between what's administrative and what's program in terms of publishing? Like, one could consider, I'm here at this conference because of my books, therefore that is my program, or it's administrative because it's staff development,
That's an excellent question. So if you are not-for-profit, I'm going to try to rephrase the question.
Sure.
It seems that certain things, one could call admin or one could call program, and who's to say, and there's your answer. When in doubt, call it program.
Okay.
You're on your own best conscience to do it correctly. Mind you, in QuickBooks or any similar program, you can split things. So you might say, in all fairness, let's say 20% of this was admin and 80% was program. Right? For you, just to be clear though, anything that's marketing, that's program. That's not admin. Admin is things like banking, paying utility bills. If you pay an actual accountant, that's admin. The real question is this task or expense mission-based? Or is it simply something we have to do, right? So to keep lights on. So writing out checks is admin. If you spend time doing that, or talking to a health insurance provider, that, you know, for your staff, that is admin. But attending a conference, that's programmatic. That's part of marketing. That's part of your program, your mission as a publisher. Exactly.
Yeah, can I add something to that too? I want to say this carefully. So a lot of these, for nonprofits, a lot of them are about assessment of risk. I have a handout here that's Know Your Audience, and the idea is to try to think about who's going to care or who's going to challenge this, right? So who really cares about how much you split? Well, the notion is basically around the IRS that your donors would have the right to sort of say, I want to know where my $50 went, right? I want to know how much you spent on the lights and how much you spent on does the IRS spend much time auditing people on these kinds of things? Anyone from the IRS here? You have to tell me. It's like being a cop. You have to tell me. No, they don't. And they're not doing much auditing of nonprofit entities. It's one of the beauties of being a 501c3, right? So you make that determination, but that's a case where, as opposed to what I often tell publishers, your cash flow. Like, if you're not sure you put your assets correctly, you think you maybe you're showing funders you've got four times as many assets as you really have, or you're not doing your liabilities right, that's a secondary problem to cash flow. It's not unimportant, and it's good to get these things correct, but if you have to say what's going to light the house on fire, it's your cash flow. You're going to run out of money in 3 months, right? So if you're going to go into a distressed nonprofit and they hire you, you're going to first say, let's get the cash flow together. We'll worry about the other stuff later, right? If we've messed up and we're booking all this money as assets as if we sold it to the distributor, right, that would be a case where maybe those aren't really assets yet. That can be done secondarily. You work with an accountant or CPA, you grow a little bit, and the way you're going to get challenged is maybe the funders are like, this seemed a little misleading, but they're probably not going to go there either. You're probably fine with the IRS. So
I will say, too, priorities. Not worrying about the IRS, but for your own running your for or nonprofit business, well, this is a not for profit thing specifically, you should know that 1% of your every dollar goes toward your mission, and 1% just goes toward brass tax administrative stuff or fundraising. Because if half of every dollar that you get is going toward administrative stuff, there's something wrong. It's not about getting caught, it's just that something terribly wrong. You're spending too much on your admin.
And your funders are going to want to know that before they give you any money.
By the way, once you start filling out a 990 form, which any of you would have to do, it appears on something called GuideStar.org. And anyone can look at it. So at the point that someone might want to give you a $1,000 check or, you know, $5,000 check or more, the first thing that anyone who writes big checks will do is look up their 990 tax form on GuideStar. And they're going to see there that three-column breakdown. And if 70% of every dollar that you get goes to fundraising, they don't want to give you money, right? So it's just a good business practice. I want to say, maybe bring up that little Excel chart, that little book projection. There's a little,
Can I quickly add, though, too, that everything you said about nonprofit is very different for-profit, right? Your risk is very different if you've told the IRS you have a different amount of assets and the IRS is not getting money that there should be due because you do have those assets. That's a different concern from the IRS than whether a nonprofit, where if they do perform an audit on a nonprofit, there's going to maybe be some fees or something, but not a lot of money is at stake. If you're for a for-profit, you may be at higher risk of a possible audit if you don't have those numbers buckled down a little bit better. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure if you do that. It's an Excel sheet called Book Income Projection. It would have to be separate. It couldn't be a tab because it itself is a whole workbook. I will say that if we can't write this up, we We had problems getting this computer on the screen, and so luckily, Rafay had a few of these documents in his computer. He might not have this one. This is a document that if you're a CLMP member, you can download from the resource library. And if you're with SPD, just email anyone at SPD, me or Brent, any of us, and we will email it to you. But there's an Excel sheet. I made it up. It's quite simple. Oh, there it is. Okay. So there's a sample on the first tab, and the other two tabs are blank, and you can fill in different numbers, and the formulas are set, and it will calculate for you. So it's not a perfect thing. It's a basic idea. But sometimes when publishers print a book, and they magically think about the book sales, and they forget about their cost. And so they may not even price the book appropriately to actually make any money. So the fact of the matter is, in this case, this is for probably a fiction book that one thinks is going to do rather well. So in this case, the printing bill was $8,500 for 7,000 books. So that's probably maybe more than most of you are doing. This is just an example. And a simple math, you can see it comes out to $1.21 cost per printed book. Okay? In this case, the book was, the cover price was $14.95, and the assumption here, and you can change this percentage in the worksheet, is that 50% of that is the discount that a bookseller will get. And that's kind of an average. So some booksellers are buying things from a distributor 40%, some are buying from a distributor 55%. Every channel gets different discounts for different reasons, right? So as a rough average, 50%. And then the net to the publisher and the distributor, so far, but not yet going to you, would be $7.48. Right? So it's half of the $14.95. But then the distributor takes a percentage for their work, because you have little people along the way. And the distributor in this case is taking 28% of that net that went to the distributor. And then the gross to you then is $5.38. And from that, you might be paying a royalty. In this case, again, you could change it here. 10%, if there's no royalty being paid, you would make that zero. But let's say it's a 10% royalty. That then is $4.84. So you might think, well, I'm going to multiply 7,000 by $4.84, and you would hopefully never do that. The fact is, you're not going to sell all 7,000 books. And this is what a lot of beginning publishers forget. You should plan already from the beginning. A bunch of those books are going to be used for marketing purposes. You're going to give them away. So I'm guessing out of 7,000 copies, 250 would be given away. Again, you can adjust this on the other pages. And again, this is just rough, but you should do at a minimum this when you're planning a book. And then reconsider the price, you know, reconsider the print run, and reconsider your printer and what it costs based on this chart. We're also going to assume, this is what we'll talk a little more about in a sec, 30%, you should assume at least 30% of the books sold are going to be returned.
That means you return or unsold.
Or unsold, okay. Yeah, thank you. I should say that. So that leaves you, out of the 7,000 printed, 4,725 are actually sold. And so that means that you actually, your net return in this case, $14,000. So any questions about this chart?
Thank you.
I also want to say that this is very critical. I had a press last year, 2 years ago, up in Canada. They won an award, then Barnes & Noble. Sorry, I confused it. It's a publisher in the U.S. won an award, poetry book. Barnes & Noble came back to them and said, we want you to print 10,000 copies. Do you know how many were returned? 80%. It almost killed the publisher. Mm-hmm. That's severe.
Yeah.
So they're looking at, hey, we have this potential order of 10,000. The downside was they sold 2,000 and they burned, like, basically to about 8,000. Between shipping and everything else, they almost wiped out that publisher.
Yeah, so many times it's better off, if you think the book's going to do really well, unless it's really, for some reason, I'm going to do phenomenally well based on real data. You're better off printing probably fewer and then reprint later. Okay. Again, we want to be careful. You know, all publishing is venture capital in some regard, and it does require a little bit of venture thinking if that's a special part of publishing. But it can't be all based on that. By the way, this chart does not include your other overhead costs. It doesn't include paying staff. Doesn't include paying an editor or a designer. So you put it at the bottom. If you pay a designer outside of your staff to design the book and do the typography and so forth, and you pay them a set fee, you should subtract that from the projected total net return.
Also, shipping to get it to your distributor, that could be another line item you should add in there for sure. People forget that a lot. Shipping to get it to a reviewer sometimes costs money.
Yeah. And also shipping to return back to books that were
passed. That's right. And also, again, since you have a little more money, are you putting money toward an author touring somewhere or toward doing a launch event? That could go in here, too. It's all part of the budget for the book. So a little extra time spent budgeting a book rather than just saying, well, let's print 2,000 and, get a couple of printer quotes. I want to say more about pricing. I think I'm not right to say more about this, but there's a misconception, if you can illustrate your question, that if you make a book cheaper, you'll sell more of them. And we'd like to introduce you to that later, but tell them why it's not good to underprice your book.
Well, as I said in the panel earlier today, booksellers are overwhelmed, right? And all the middle people in bookselling and the book trade have way more data than books than they can possibly look at. And it is one of the factors that they look at, right? Is the book priced to market? If it's not, even though you say to yourself, well, then the reader is more likely to grab it, that does raise red flags for them, partly because it looks like the press maybe doesn't know what they're doing in other departments. They don't know what the market price tag is. It just seems odd. It seems out of place. And, of course, those middle people are making a margin, a percent cut of the sale. So books too cheap, they're going to make less. Obviously, if it's too expensive for the market, then they're going to just see customers in their mind walk away. But either way, it's indicative that you are professional. You kind of know what the market is. And they're looking for reasons to kind of, I'm going to ignore that book. Something doesn't feel.
So for a bookstore, you're taking up valuable shelf space, and if they can sell a book in the same space, that will make them more money. They may go for the other book. It's also just a sort of human nature thing. You may think by making the book super cheap that people will buy more of them, but you may also be devaluing your product so that it seems like it's worth less. So frequently, do a little basic research. Go to a bookstore. What other books are like your book? And your price should probably be similar. Okay.
Oh, yeah, I had a question on sort of the continuation aspect of this that you were talking about, and I couldn't do it quite today, but you might have touched on this earlier. But do you recommend doing this so early in the process and looking at this and saying, how much staff time should we comfortably devote to this, or do you let that sort of overhead staff component of it have a life of its own and then plan?
Right, so this is like not for profit management issue, I'll kind of rephrase the question. So the question is, in projecting this book income, and as I said, this is the most basic part that it did not include overhead issues, paying a designer, some other aspect. Shipping is not on here. The things that you sort of pay for overall. Should you think about things like staff time capacity? The answer is absolutely yes. So, for example, if you're planning for the year to put out 8 books, do a little staff time analysis and look at the calendar. And you might be better served, and quite frankly, I'll make a bold statement, better serving your authors by publishing fewer books. Your capacity is your capacity, and you only have so many hours of the day, and if you're going to have to then pay to bring in extra help to accomplish something, that's an additional cost that you have to know you can pay for. Remind you, too, that this money you're earning on this chart, even if it happens exactly like this, that's very theoretical, you're not going to see that money for quite some time. Yes, question.
I have 2 thoughts on the pricing. One is on course adoptions.
Yes.
We've had a lot of people course adopt because our books are cheaper. They're not like weird, like the bookstore doesn't would say what you're
right.
saying.
To the
but
market.
Like a lot of textbooks are like $70 and
yeah.
our books are up 20, and this is just, what is the basic comment, not a question. that actually we've had professors choose that for their students. And the other piece is that as a nonprofit with a mission, like, we want these books to get people. And again, I get your thing about making it $3 and nobody thinks
that's right.
like you're devaluing. But, I mean, we try to go as low within reasonable market as we can because we want to get out there. Also, we have to keep under that sales thing in the nonprofit thing where you have to have this 33% grants and funding. So, like, if you have, like, a huge sales year with a $30 book, like, then we have a weird, you know what I'm talking about?
That's not a lot.
What?
That's a recommendation. That's not a
Our accountant.
Your accountant probably said, maybe you had an amazing sales rep. I'm concerned that your earned income is so high that it might be jeopardizing your not-for-profit status, but...
Yeah, just a couple of years where we've had, big sales.
Yeah. No, as a not-for-profit, you can earn money. It's going for admission. It's fine.
Okay.
In fact, may I tell a...
Yeah, please do.
Very brief. Our accountant, I just love this story. He said, you know, there was a time when the IRS would tend to question people's 501c3 status and remove them. That he says they are so demoralized over there. And this comes from, you remember that, where the Republicans were saying that the IRS had incorrectly, you know, tried to revoke statuses. He said, I'm just quoting, and that really nobody in the IRS is revoking any 501c3 statuses anytime soon for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. By the way,
so that's the only danger you come up in, you know, that kind of question. It really is not common. I have not heard it take
place. Don't change your book price because of that. That's fine. That's really just not true. It's really not true. The other thing I want to say is, if any of you are currently a for-profit thinking about becoming a not-for-profit, now is a very good time to do it, because whereas it used to be really hard before because there was a lot of scrutiny, they are so understaffed, they're just putting them right through. So now is the best time to apply for not-for-profit status. You'll get it in record time. They can't deal with it.
And I've actually done a business valuation for a nonprofit becoming a for-profit entity and rolling up other nonprofits, but you have to file a valuation report with the Secretary of State, whatever state you're listed in, because they want to make sure you're not taking those assets of the nonprofit for the benefit of the for-profit. So they hired me to do the report, and it was fine because the nonprofit was losing money. But you can do that. Keep that in mind. But there are options to go back and forth. You just have to make sure you follow the rules.
Yeah,
this is a follow. This follows on directly. If you could speak more generally about what kinds of things accountants and tax professionals routinely fail to understand about small press publishing. So, what are some of those?
Yeah. So the question is: are there things that a general accountant may find may not really know about small press accounting, in particular? And I'll say also not-for-profit accounting for many of you, which is a special niche. One is certainly royalties. Structures. Another is the special term, we're going to introduce the term bad debt, that's a good time to do it. That is a line that shows up on publisher budgets and financials that would not generally be, would usually almost never be on a regular not for profits accounting. So bad debt, someone tells what bad debt is. It sounds awful, it's not your fault. It sounds like it's your fault, but it's not.
It's uncollectible money from retailers, usually bookstores, going out of business. You thought you had a sale and you didn't.
Right. So your distributor says, we sold all this money and we sold these books, hope to have a check in 6 months to you. And then it turns out that all those sales went to stores that went out of business. And that money does not come to you. And you have to write it off. And that's what writing off is. And it's called bad debt. It's the money that you say, you know what, I'm never getting this receivable. So you can't just erase it. You have to put it into a line called bad debt to show that it's uncollectible. That's what that does. There's another line similar, and it has to do with what we spoke about a moment ago, returns. A good practice, you're going to get returns. No one prints 1,000 books and sells 1,000 books. It doesn't happen. So some books will be returned. Beyond the ones that you give away for free for marketing, you're probably going to have some returns. Best-selling books in the world get returns. Bookstores will order many more of them than they think they can sell because the books are. So we recommend generally that small presses will have a line called reserve against returns. Right? Someone will tell us what that is, sort of obvious, but.
Well, yeah, again, it just counteracts that supposed income with the expectation that some books are going to come back at some percent.
So you're putting a little money aside to cover the return costs.
Where does that line go?
In the balance sheet.
In the balance
sheet. Yeah,
balance sheet. Generally.
So it's outside of your P&L, right? It's below the line, let's say. It's not an expense category. But in your balance sheet, you want to have this lump of money called reserve against returns, and that's a good practice. So that when books come back, they don't really sell. When they did sell, but then you don't collect money, and the books come back to you, you still have the books.
And so if it's going in the balance sheet, does it also appear in the cash flow?
Yeah, you can put it in your own cash flow. Remember, no one's saying your cash flow except you. If I knew, I need you and your staff and your board and
they have a board. You've
got to keep it in mind. It's an internal document, but I would definitely put it on the cash flow.
Yes.
Right, yeah.
For example, another line in the cash flow that would not show up in a P&L would be if you owe money on a credit card, using your credit card a lot for the business, and you're paying off a big balance, payments to your credit card might be a nice line on your internal cash flow. It's not going to show up anywhere else. You'll have a big liability for credit card, but you want to show paying off for yourself. Like, I think December, when we do the year-end fundraising, let's see if we can take $2,000 of the $2,500 we think we'll get and just pay it off the credit card. You know, that's the kind of thing that would be typical of a cash flow. It's an internal document.
If I could also, the other thing about that question, that it goes back to, you know, what do, even our very much non-profit CPA accounting firm, who only audits non-profits, did have a lot of trouble in the early days with that question of the functional expenses, that place where in the IRS form or in your audit or whatever, you're going to break down what's programming, what's G&L, what's...
Oh, I should have said, I never said that before. That's often called functional expenses.
The statement of functional expenses. It's in the 990 form. So you might say, as those questions come up, you might say, well, these are book sales, so, and this part of our program. To many accountants, especially for-profit accountants, that's very weird, right? Like, well, this is a product, so you're selling it, so it can't be a program. So you do have to make the case, and the case is quite solid, but a lot of accounts are just so used to anything that's kind of sold as an object. You got to kind of bring them along to kind of say, it's really not different than putting on a play, it's really not different than a kind of musical, you know, all these 501c3s equivalents where, of course, you're not expecting to, you know, that is programming. Publishing the book is the programming. I'm sorry that it happens to look like an object that can exist.
By the way, many
like a bar of soap or something.
Exactly. Many funders also have a problem with this. They do not understand that not-for-profit bookselling is a program. Even though they may fund theater and understand that the theater sells tickets, but they still give them a grant because, in fact, they're subsidizing the ticket sale. In essence, they are subsidizing your book sale. If you didn't have any contributing income as a not-for-profit press, you would have to charge perhaps twice as much for each book because of the smaller programs. That's the idea. So you have to kind of educate frequently your accountant. They're not used to it. I have a question here.
Yeah, we operate as part of a public college, so we're non-profit in that sense. What sort of accounting system?
You are non-profit then.
Okay.
You're a program of a not-for-profit, then you are a not-for-profit.
So I run a 12-year-old literary nonprofit. When beginning, we didn't publish books, or we co-published with another major publisher out of Berkeley. We have gradually grown our publishing arm to now we're actually getting attention. But I'm familiar with all of the financial documents that you are showing, except our bookkeeper doesn't treat it like a small press. What kind of advice would you give me to adding some of these things in, like reserve against returns?
Yeah.
Or do we need to treat them as two separate entities? Do we?
The way that he might think that it might be more internal for you, I'm going to make one recommendation.
She lumps all of our publications income under one line instead of by book.
Yeah. You just may have to keep a separate set of books. Maybe a separate QuickBooks that's just for your publishing. I think of it as a program, and that program is its own accounting.
Yeah, and we do think of it as a program, so, okay.
I would say, too, though, at SPD, it's been like a 12-year journey where each year our CPAs were like, why don't we try this year, you know? So 1 year we had it in the reserve against returns, right? You have to keep in mind that these financial statements, the balance sheet in particular, like I said, can be a little bit off. What matters is, are you making decisions? Are you making financial decisions by looking at your balance sheet? If you're not sure that these things really are, these assets are assets and these liabilities are liabilities, then you really should rely on your cash flow for, like, are we or are we not going to spend this money, right? That's where you kind of say, got a big check, got a big decision. If you're trying to turn to your balance sheet yourself and make internal decisions and your assets are not, you know, you don't have a reserve against return, so you can get in trouble at that point, right? So these are things you kind of know. But year by year, you can start to, with your bookkeeper, maybe say, let's start with this. Okay, we really think this is the biggest financial risk, but the truth is these returns could swamp us at any moment. Let's build that one line, and then next year we'll look at something else that where this one asset looks really big, but really there's some reasons to doubt it. And you can start to construct that.
On a purely practical level, so probably right now you have basic functional expenses. I guess you have program and fundraising, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
okay.
So under program, publishing might be one of the cost centers?
It is.
But within that, and it might be that you have a separate QuickBooks that your account is doing for you.
Which I don't, yeah.
Every book wants a column. Every book is a project. So that you can separately project income. It might be just in your cash flow. You want to be projecting income and loss, perhaps, of every
sure.
single one. Otherwise, you just can't know.
So where do I find tools for that specific? Like, I'm
right.
coming at it from scratch.
Sure. So, something like this, again, this could be internal documents. It's not so much about the accounting that makes a tax return.
Right.
Totals are fine for that. But for you to project things, you could just reproduce this. If you have 6 points, reproduce it 6 times. That's all. And just have you show me a column in your own Excel sheet.
I mean, we get a full-fledged annual audit, right, and in the Bay Area. And they're wonderful people, and they are less expensive than quite a lot. But, you know, it's about $6,000-$7,000. It's not cheap. But there are things called financial reviews that a CPA could do. It might be worth, you know, looking at.
You've done that a couple of times.
Yeah, but I will say, they try to find some of those.
Yeah, but they're not going to think about much.
They don't know anything about publishing.
They won't.
It's very specific.
No, you need to
use our hands.
Yeah. But
you're in the Bay Area?
Huh?
You're in the Bay Area?
No, I'm in Southern California.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I actually, the Inland Empire of Southern California.
Oh, that's right.
But again, the accounting for your tax returns is about totals. I don't think that's what Greg's about. Greg's about how you really track each book.
Right. And our royalties is our biggest
problem. It's a nice topic because we only have 5 minutes left, and we haven't addressed royalties, so I think that's the one remaining thing we really need to address. So a bunch of you did put your hands up for paying royalties, right? It's frequent that poetry publishers don't pay royalties. The author may get just a fee, or it's not even advanced. They just get a fee, and then that's it. Or they get copies for very small publishers. Other genres tend to get royalties. And once you're paying royalties, things get really complicated really fast. So one thing to think about, so I'm going to put this out there, and then we'll try to answer questions or talk about it. We obviously cannot address all of these issues in an hour, but you know, just to put out the issues for you. One thing to think about is, will you pay royalties or not, is the question, first of all. Knowing that once you are paying royalties, which is certainly what you should aspire to, right? Because you want to pay your authors. But it's hard. It's really hard to keep track of. So remember that every book you publish doesn't go away next year. You keep adding. So you're tracking royalties on every title forever, unless you decide it's out of print, right? So that's one. So to pay or not. And is there also, are you paying in advance? And generally, royalties are against in advance. So you have to really be keeping track of the advance you gave. And as you're accruing royalties, you're not paying out royalties until you cover the advance. So that's one more thing you have to keep track of. That one's not so hard. You have to do it. Are you paying royalties? And there's no best way to do it. I'll just say, but some people pay royalties on net, and some people on gross or rather cover price. So you can pay on cover price or net. It's very generous to pay on the cover price. I'm going to recommend in general it's better to pay royalties on them, because if your book is priced at $14.95 but it's not selling all that well, and so you let them go at $2 a piece, and then you owe the author a royalty that's more than that, you're literally losing money with every sale. You don't want that. They should be getting a percentage of what you earn. So that's just my recommendation. Any other quick tips?
Yeah, I just recommend using Excel.
Yeah.
We've looked at software programs, but unless you're printing 100, there's a cost to it. So just map it out on Excel, do it by hand, put it into Excel. It's the simplest, easiest way.
Yeah. And remember that when you do pay royalties, maybe one caveat, if there's any other sort of quickie things, we'll see if there's a question or two. You don't pay the royalty out when the sale happens. You have to wait, I would say, 6 months or even a year, because you have to wait for the returns to come in to know what the book actually earned. So if you're paying out royalties the moment you sell a book, and then all those books come back, you're not going to ask the author to pay you back. That would be horrible. So you want to give it a year to know what a book really sold. Once a year, paying royalties once a year is not terrible. So you have time to calculate them with the returns in mind.
And I'd say, you know, we know that you're trying to entice authors, and this doesn't matter, but I would suggest the possibility of, for small press, you know, that maybe there is a number. 101st, you start the royalties, let's say, the 101st, 150th copy. And what that does is that, you know, the one that really tanks, you're already taking a bath anyway, and in that case, the least you're not having to worry about royalties. So, you know, maybe the royalty rate is just a tad bit higher, but it starts on the 150th copy sold. The first 150 just don't pay royalty. So that's very, you can structure it any way you want, but I think most authors will kind of see a reasonableness of that.
Do we have, I think we have time for one or two questions, if I could go back. Yeah.
Yeah, just one quick question, I hope, is are there resources or books you recommend that maybe would help one find their way into this in a more organized fashion, like QuickBooks for Dummies, for example, or...
QuickBooks for Dummies is great.
Great book. Yeah.
That's your best first
book.
Okay. Yeah, it's really good. Yes.
When you say acid, how is it the price that you sell the book for or the price that you bought the book for?
What is it?
So what does acid mean, the price you put on the book, you mean?
Right.
Before you sold it, or the actual amount you sold?
You pay $5 to get the book from the printer, and then you sell it for $10.
Right.
Is the acid $5 or $10?
Yeah, that's one that changes.
Well,
I thought it was a quick question.
So
you know, it's a really good question. It's a hard one to answer. The answer is you can't just multiply the cover price, because you're never really going to sell every copy you have at that price. But you know if you did sell a book, what amount would come back to you based on that sort of that chart. You know what you get back from the distributor. By the way, if you sell directly, you're making more. And some books are sold directly, I like readings, and some are sold through a distributor. So you have to take a guess. If you do a lot of events in your poetry, for example, you probably sell more through events and fewer from the distributor. If you know, other kinds of books might sell more from a distributor, very few in person. So you have to make a fair calculation on your own of what you can really make from a book. But the amount you would make from a book, also guesstimating the number that are going to be returned and the number given away that don't sell, that are marketing. By the way, there are damaged books too along the way. There's always like leakage, right? That's the asset. So it's a little bit up to you. It's a kind of trust-based thing a little bit. There isn't one absolute way to say what the value of a book that's in your garage that you might sell later is.
I just want to highlight again that if you have questions, I'll have cards up here. But joining CLMP is a great asset. That's why we built this program. Because through CLMP, you can just sign up, get access to me, talk to me about it, and we'll have questions. But that's why you join CLMP. You have the resources.
And we have, just as a parting gift to you, we have a little handout that explains some of this stuff here. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.